Circuit. Hearing. All persons having business before this honorable court are invited to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument is Lust v. Seeley. Ms. Morris.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. This case presents a classic example of what juries are prohibited from doing. Juries are not permitted to substitute their own judgment for the employer's judgment. Yet that is precisely what this jury did. It substituted its judgment for that of Al Bolden, who was the decision maker in this case. There was nothing in the record to support a finding that Bolden discriminated against the plaintiff. The judge grabbed at straws in order to support this verdict. And when you look at the evidence in the context of the entire record, it does not support a finding of discrimination. The court went right off track right from the beginning when she stated that two individuals, Panthers and Bolden, were involved in deciding who would receive the Chicago promotion. This is wrong. It was Bolden who made the July 2000 betting experts promotion decision. The plaintiff argued repeatedly about alleged statements made by Panthers, which she claimed were inappropriate, trying to taint Bolden and attribute Panthers' alleged statements to Bolden. This resulted in confusing the jury. The jury went barreling down the wrong track, focusing on Panthers instead of what it should have been focusing on, which is Bolden. Bolden made the decision to select Steve West for KAM, key account manager position, in July of 2000 after he solicited input from each of his seven district managers.
You say the jury went astray. So why do you think they went astray? It's a pretty straightforward case. Why?
I think that they got confused by the plaintiff's presentation of testimony and constantly focusing on Panthers instead of looking at the evidence in the context of the whole record, which is the fact that it was Bolden who made the decision. Bolden.
Well, he had input from Panthers.
He had input from Panthers, as he had input from each of his seven other district sales managers, and input from his two regional counterparts. He reviewed his own list. Bolden reviewed his list of eligible candidates, including the plaintiffs.
Well, didn't Lust also present evidence that when she was asked why she wasn't promoted, she was not told by Bolden or Panthers that she lacked the interpersonal skills, did not want to move, or that she couldn't handle the rough and tumble environment at betting experts? That was evidence that was before the jury.
Your Honor, actually, I don't believe that was correct. She never asked. She only asked Panthers at one occasion, and Panthers was not the decision maker. So Panthers did not necessarily even know what Bolden's reasons were. Bolden had one conversation with her in August, late August of 2000.
Right, but he didn't say the reason why she didn't get the promotion, though. Right, he didn't identify these reasons, the lack of an appropriate
skills. The evidence shows that he was never asked those reasons. The conversation that Bolden had called plaintiff after she had written comments on her evaluation, and Bolden called plaintiff to discuss the comments, but there's no evidence that she ever asked Bolden what his reasons were. And in fact, Bolden's reasons were not Panthers' reasons. Betting experts had nothing to do with what Bolden's reasons were. Bolden's reasons and his concerns about plaintiff's interpersonal skills based on the Steinhoffel complaint, those concerns were documented in his memo that documented his conversation with the plaintiff in August of 2000, and that was a memo that the court refused to allow into evidence, which I believe was educated.
I don't understand, actually, I don't understand how any of Bolden's memos could get into evidence, except, of course, used as admissions by Lust. Ordinarily, a party can't write out-of-court statements and have them get into evidence to corroborate his testimony. That's basic hearsay law.
I think they were, it comes in under the business record exception for one thing.
I don't understand that. I mean, business record exception is for things where, you know, you have a clerk and he routinely records this and that and the other thing, and it's kept for reasons unrelated to the litigation. But when you have a party, or amounts to a party, official of a party writing, you know, self-exculpatory statements all over the place, it seems to me then they're not admissible. They shouldn't be admissible. They have absolutely no value. I mean, anyone can sit down and write a document and says, gee, you know, I'm a great guy and I never discriminate and so on, and then you want to throw that in front of a jury? No.
I'd like to point out a couple of things. These were notes that were made contemporaneously, immediately after
the telephone conversation.
I don't know
what difference that makes. I mean, of course, it's a natural impulse to want to write a self-exculpatory memo as soon as you've done something bad, right? That's human nature.
Your Honor, there was nothing that needed to be self-exculpatory.
Self or not, I don't understand why documents of this sort have any reliability any likelihood of reliability that ought to make them admissible.
I think the fact that they were recorded immediately after the
event. I don't know what difference that makes.
And
why should that make any difference?
I think it shows their accuracy, and there is
accurate? What is the incentive to tell the truth when you're writing a memo about your own conduct?
He isn't writing it about his conduct. He is simply, has been no discrimination complaint filed either at this point.
Well,
it doesn't need to be self-explanatory.
But he knows what's coming.
Right. He learned of Luff's decision to file suit. He knew of her decision to file suit.
That's wrong, Your Honor. That's wrong,
so
Your Honor.
So you're saying that's an inaccurate characterization by
I am saying that.
Appellant.
This memo was written, the first one was written August 28th. The only action that had occurred as of this point in time is that plaintiff had written comments on her August 2000 appraisal. The suit was not filed until 2 days later, on August 30th.
Right, but they knew about her decision to file suit.
No. They knew that she was upset. She had never said, she had never made any claim whatsoever as of that point in time that she was going to be filing a suit.
Well, the fact that she was so upset was certainly a signal that perhaps something might be coming down the pike, and perhaps one should generate something that would be helpful in the future.
The two memos that I'm really talking about here, the only thing that they do is they record a conversation, and they discuss in the context of his conversation with her what her concerns were. They document that his surprise that he didn't know that she was interested in moving.
Documenting his surprise. I mean, that's just a self-exculpatory, out-of-court statement. Well, I don't think it has any reliability at all.
I think that the legal basis for these is set forth in our brief,
I don't find it persuasive.
I'd like to.
Plus, we're dealing with an abuse of discretion standard, aren't we, in terms of the admissibility of the evidence? So, you know, I mean, I think you have to make a case as to why the court abused its discretion, and there are no cases that you've cited that support your position in this context.
I don't believe that I found cases. I believe that I believe that they were recorded for purposes of discussing the situation with his supervisor so that he would.
But I'm saying there are lots of business records exception cases out there, and this isn't the first time this issue has been faced. And so, you know, when we're trying to balance in the standards of abuse of discretion, if you find cases that are kind of like our situation, that could be helpful to you. But go ahead.
I'd actually like to turn back to the focus on Bolden again, because this is where I think that the jury really started getting off track in the first place. The decision here was made by Bolden. He selected Steve West only after seeking input from a number of other individuals, and he interviewed West, as well as two other individuals, a male and a female, and he selected West. It is undisputed that West was a good sales representative. His performance appraisal.
But don't you think what's going on here is that they didn't think a woman was appropriate for this betting experts company because of these animal-like behavior of the employees there?
No, Your Honor. And I believe that this is where the jury.
But would that be wrong? I mean, suppose instead of saying it wasn't suitable for a woman, suppose they said it wouldn't be suitable for anyone who was refined.
Your Honor,
that would be on the bench anyway.
I'm sorry, I couldn't understand.
What I said was that would rule off part of the bench anyway, but go ahead.
The first thing that I'd like to point out, Your Honor, is that betting experts was never a criteria that was considered by
Golden. But there'd be nothing wrong if a company said, look, we have this valuable client, they're a bunch of animals, so we need to send one of our animals. So that wouldn't be discriminatory, as long as they didn't think all women are, you know, prissy and all men are tough, right? That would be discriminatory. But if they just said, we have less and more refined salesmen, and we'll send the less refined to betting experts. That wouldn't be improper.
I agree with you,
Your Honor. But you didn't. But that's not your argument, right?
Well, our testimony
Yours is denial.
No, Your Honor. Our testimony was that Seeley did not consider that account good for some men, just as well as it didn't consider it good for some women. And in fact, it had assigned women to work at that account before, and that testimony is in the record. But my major point here is that betting experts gets it off track simply because that nature of the betting experts account was not considered by Bolden. That was not one of his criteria. What Bolden was looking at is, number one, West was a good, very qualified salesperson. West had told him on several occasions that he wanted to be promoted and had stated that he was more than happy to move to be promoted. And number two, West did not carry the negatives that the plaintiff carried simply because the plaintiff had her largest account express concerns about how well she had related and interrelated with the buyer for that account and the sales staff in that account.
I thought she had repaired her relationship with, what was her name, Loring or
Luling?
Yeah. So there is evidence that they were getting along fine.
What the testimony was from Steinhoffer was that it had improved, not resolved. And the key here
is a testimony that Loring missed Lust when
that testimony became was very after friendly. After Lust was reassigned, not at the time that Bolden was making the decision. That was not what Bolden knew of. And what's key here is that it is whether that was a legitimate concern of Bolden's when he was making the betting experts promotion decision in July of 2000.
Let me ask you a question about the punitive damages. You argue on the basis of the Kolstad decision, but you didn't request an instruction. So isn't that waiver?
Instruction as to what, Your Honor?
As to that good faith compliance.
Your Honor, I don't believe that there is any requirement that good faith be part of the jury instruction. I could find nothing in the research that said that you have to raise that as part of good faith. And in a jury instruction.
If the jury is going to determine punitive damages and you have a theory under which punitive damages would be improper, you have to give it to the jury. They have to decide whether it's good faith.
And
right?
I did argue that Seeley had acted in good faith as part of my argument to the jury. I'd like to save my...
No, but I'd like to finish that. And certainly having a instruction on good faith would have perhaps put some teeth in the argument that you made. I mean, normally when you have a theory like that, you do present it to the jury. And, you know, I see it as you want to address the waiver, why it's not waiver.
Your Honor, I didn't, you know, number one, I don't believe it was waived because we did raise it with the jury.
I mean, right, but you didn't present any law on it. Right, the jury didn't have that in a jury instruction.
I don't believe that we had good faith in the jury instruction, but we certainly talked about, during the argument, what was necessary to be able to establish in the fact that Seeley had acted in
the jury. But don't you have some burden to give the court the law on that so the jury can be instructed on it?
I don't recall exactly. It's my recollection we did talk about the Kolstad.
So you never offered an instruction?
I don't believe that there was a legal requirement that we have a separate instruction on good faith.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Morris.
Thank you.
Mr. Gingrich?
Excuse me. The wonders of modern science, huh?
Good morning. May it please the court. A couple of matters of clarification before I begin my argument. There was a question from the court as to the timing of plaintiff's first concern about discriminatory practices. And the memo written by Mr. Bolden came only days after she specifically set forth in her employee appraisal that she thought she'd been the victim of gender discrimination.
Well, the issue was whether they were aware of the fact she was going to file a lawsuit, not that you had a beef coming.
I understand, but I think it's highly relevant as to the admissibility of that memo that they knew at that time that...
Would you characterize it as a business document, business record?
No, I would not.
It was not kept in the normal course of business. It's not part of the normal business for them to keep such records of employee interviews.
I don't think in this context it would.
No,
qualify.
I say normally speaking.
Correct. I don't think it would qualify.
So that if they keep records of their employee interviews, they are inadmissible documents?
If this were an employee interview document that was recorded...
Well,
in
what
the,
was it?
It was an interview investigating the plaintiff's concern about gender
discrimination. And it was a document.
Excuse me?
And it was a document.
It was a document.
And it was a document pertaining to an interview of an employee relative to employment.
In that general sense,
yes. Yeah, okay, in that general sense. And those are generally kept as a business record.
In that general frame of your question, yes.
Goody. I knew we'd get to that point.
Thank you. The other thing I wanted to clarify is as to the alleged interview process by Mr. Bolden of these two other applicants. As we said in our brief, there were no interview notes of those interviews put forth into evidence. Neither of those other applicants were called forward to testify that they were interviewed. There's an absence of a hiring process in terms of those other consideration of those other applicants.
And so with respect to business record, how does that factual context support your position?
I was bringing that up in the context that to question whether Mr. Bolden, in fact, actually considered other applicants other than Mr. West, who was served up to him by Mr. Penters. And I think that's clear on the record. And that's where Mr. Penters' attitudes come into play in this promotional process.
Entirely. Wouldn't the question of whether or not this was done in contemplation of the lawsuit, the notations made during the interview, go to the weight to be given to such interview on cross-examination rather than to the admissibility of the document as a business record?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think
I didn't want you to confess error on the spot, but I want under normal circumstances, is what I said correct? Business record of an interview which would be available, and your cross-examination would bring out that the interview itself was, and the notes on the interview was based on the fact that they had contemplated the possibility of a lawsuit that was self-serving?
I think that makes it not admissible in this context.
So that there is an exception to the business record rule that says that if you have decided, on what predicate, I don't know, that the simply a timing that it was done in the kind of place that it is inadmissible?
Well, I don't think this was a regularly recorded business document. This was the only...
Well, I thought we had already established that under normal circumstances, they interview employees that pertain to as a regular thing, and they keep records of that, and they're kept in permanent file.
In a regular employment procedure, yes. This was not such a regular employment procedure.
I mean, they don't do that normally?
Not in this context, and they put...
And not with this woman.
Excuse me?
Not with this woman.
And not with any other...
Is that the first time she was ever interviewed in connection with her employment?
No, but this was the first time that she ever...
Did they take records of when she was interviewed before?
She was not interviewed for this promotion at all.
I understand, but had they interviewed her on prior occasions relative to her employment and kept copies of those interview records in her file?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Really?
She was only interviewed, I believe, once, and that was at the beginning of her employment years ago.
Was there anything in the record about that interview?
There was not.
Did you look?
Yes. I mean, I know there's nothing in the record about her first interview with the company in this record.
How would you know there was an interview then?
I'm assuming there was an interview.
But you told me there was one.
I believe there was one, but I can't be certain of that. I'm assuming there was because typically there is an interview when someone is first hired to the employment
And
program.
Typically they keep record of what the interview consisted of.
In that context, yes.
And so that becomes a part of the business record.
I think that does qualify as a business record.
And if they had further interviews for various other things, promotion and so on, that would be kept as a business record.
In terms of promotion, yes.
Yeah.
But
Nothing unusual at all about it. It's a business record.
Well, not in this sense when she has just complained of gender discrimination.
She complains and all the interviews and all the records are now inadmissible that have to do with that interview.
Well, there was no foundation by the defendant that such a record taken in response to a complaint
understand your beef was that there was no foundation laid for the introduction of a business record, but that it was not a business record.
And the lower court said it was not a business record. And
I know, that's why we're here.
I understand. I don't think the necessary proof or foundation was laid that it was a normal...
So your objection was that the foundation was lacking.
Yes, and it was also a clearly self-serving document.
Well, that's different.
Well...
In the introduction. I assume the only reason to be offered is it was self-serving. Seldom does somebody offer a document that would destroy their position.
Documents that are kept in the normal business practice
right. Are
not necessarily meant to be just self-serving. This document
True.
Was.
Well, some of them are quite self-serving, aren't they?
I don't agree with that. If they're kept...
Business records that are kept in the normal course of business are available for introduction. If they are self-serving, are inadmissible? Is that the statement?
I think that's a factor that goes into whether or not they're a regularly kept business document.
Let me ask you this. The court did allow the substance of what was contained in the memo in evidence. True.
So
the jury heard the testimony.
The court did. I think each side questioned Mr. Boland extensively about the contents of the memo. Yes. The lower court found sufficient evidence to uphold the finding by the jury that there was gender discrimination. And there were two main themes to the evidence presented, two stereotypical prejudices towards the plaintiff's gender. The first was when she first learned she didn't get the promotion, she was told that it was because she had children and she didn't want to move. And this is documented in the record through the defendant's own documents. She asked Mr. Pinters why she had not been offered the promotion to betting expert. And he said, "You were not promoted because you have kids, you won't move." She was angry and she said again, "Why am I not getting the promotion?" And he remained silent and had no answers for her. And I think this goes to the court's questions about these other reasons that are now being advanced in this litigation, Steinhoffel's, the other reasons. They were never brought to her attention when she asked, "Why am I not getting that promotion?" It was simply the assumption that they thought she would not move because she had children. And the court down below hit it straight on the head. that this type of stereotypical view towards women is discriminatory on the basis of gender. And the court cited the Phillips Supreme Court case. Denying a woman a promotion because of a stereotypical belief about her obligation to her family is discrimination on the basis of sex. In this day and age, you cannot assume that a woman employee would or should make children their first priority when deciding whether to promote them. Mr. Bolden made the same very assumption when he gave his first reason for not giving her or not considering her for that promotion. He didn't think she would move. And this was in the face of their own document where she indicated she would move on their relocation chart. It's clear that both Mr. Pinter and Mr. Bolden were operating under this illegal assumption. The second theme that the lower court focused on, and before I get to that, there were other statements made in the record. Mr. Panthers asked plaintiff why her husband wasn't going to support her when she was discussing a promotional opportunity in 1998. He made comments frequently in 97, 98, 99, and some in 2000 about, oh, you're just like a woman. Oh, you're just being a blonde today. And the lower court correctly held these types of statements to be admissible because they related to, they provided context to the statement that Mr. Pinter made when she asked, why didn't I get the promotion? They related to his state of mind as to not moving because you have kids. And under the Gorentz and Schuster cases, that type of statement is admissible. The second theme that the lower court based its findings upon was this rough and tumble Chicago job. There was no reasonable explanation for this reason other than gender. The courts have repeatedly held that you cannot discriminate against a woman because you think a job may be too unpleasant for her or too confrontational for her, and that's exactly what happened in this case. They thought she couldn't handle the job because she was a woman. They articulated no other reason other than that. And this court in Emo has talked about this type of stereotypical paternalistic attitude that's illegal towards women. That you think they're too confrontational or unpleasant, and the court has repeatedly talked about that. The court down below also clearly based its decision upholding the verdict on the pretextual nature of the defendant's conduct. They advanced these reasons, the Steinhoffel, the Sickers thing. Neither of those things were in Mr. Pinter's September 99 memo recommending plaintiff for promotion, and they predated that memo. If those were really a concern to the employer, they would have been in that memo. Similarly, if they were really a concern to Mr. Bolden, he wouldn't have promoted plaintiff days after she complained of gender discrimination. And the court down below basically said, an employer has something to hide when they do such an about-face.
Well, you know, I don't think your opponent made this argument, but that's rather questionable type of argument under 407, right? The subsequent repairs rule. You're not supposed to point to remedial efforts and say, aha, that shows, you know, they repaired the defective porch. That shows that they knew they had been negligent. So similarly, the fact they promote her quickly after she complains shouldn't be used to as evidence of guilt, sense of guilt. Otherwise, they won't do that, right? They'll know in the future that once they get into a problem like this, they better not try to repair it until the lawsuit is over.
Your Honor, Rule 407 was never advanced.
No, I understand. They don't argue it, but I think it's a legitimate concern.
And if their real legitimate concern was to rectify the situation, they would have admitted that they had engaged in some form of inappropriate
conduct. Well, you're asking them to confess. What Judge Posner is suggesting to you is that it's an argument that you shouldn't make, even if it wasn't made by the opponent, you shouldn't respond to it because it doesn't make sense. That if they do make an adjustment, give you promotion, you point and say, aha, see, they must have realized they had done something wrong. If they were trying to correct something, they should have said so.
But the courts...
Why bother with the argument is what he suggested.
I don't necessarily agree that Rule 407 applies to this type of legal action, because it relates to the good faith defense that the courts allow the defendants to bring in these types of cases to address this very concern. And the courts have said that if you do a good deed, such as in the David case...
But the good faith is ahead of time. The good faith is although the discriminatory act was committed, you were acting in good faith. You had done whatever you could to prevent it, something like that. Taking remedial steps afterwards, which might just be taken to head off a lawsuit, and not necessarily an acknowledgement of guilt at all.
But I think the good faith defense does in fact relate to conduct by the employer after the fact. And that's what the David and other cases, the Brusso cases, talk about, is a good deed taken after the fact does not insulate you from an award of punitive damages.
No, it certainly doesn't insulate, but you don't want to use the good deed taken after the fact as evidence of guilt, right? Because that just discourages people from doing good deeds. Anyway, your time's expired. Do you have anything vital you want to add? Or
just one thing on damages, Your Honor. I think there has been waiver by the defense in certain respects. Rule 50, the Rule 50 motion, the good faith defense, because it was not given to the jury. And lastly, they never raised the due process clause as a defense down below. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Gingrich. Ms. Morris, your time expired, but if you'd like a minute to rebut, if you want to stay at the table, you can. That's just... You know, speak up, but that's fine.
There are just a couple points that I'd like to make. First, what the counsel again did here is what he did before the jury, which is try to confuse Panthers with Golden. Panthers' recommendation of plaintiffs or opinion of plaintiffs is not Golden. And when Panthers recommended plaintiffs, and he did recommend her several times for promotion, Golden rejected it. Golden did not believe, based on the design of the complaint, that she was had existed the right in the person's field to be promoted yet to a PAM position. I'd also like to point out that the court made a very significant evidentiary error in refusing to allow Golden to testify on whether recommendation of plaintiff would have made a difference. Plaintiff is trying to attribute Panther's bias to Golden, but when we tried to ask Golden, would it have made a difference in your decision if Panther had recommended her, the court would not allow Golden to testify whether it would have made a difference. But yet the court goes on to say it would have made a difference. And Golden would have collected the plaintiff. That is pure speculation.
Okay. Pursuing Judge Bauer's question about the business records, I noticed in your brief you only have a sentence on this, and you say that Bolden's testimony showed that these documents were prepared in the regular course of his duties, which is fine, but you don't actually say that there was a practice of preparing documents of this sort. It's related to this question of a foundation. Is there anything actually in the record about what kind of records the company keeps with regard to its personnel?
Your Honor, it's my best recollection that the
Well, keeping notes is not exactly the same thing. I mean, is there some corporate practice that these notes are collected somewhere, retained, or is it just his personal practice of keeping notes? Because you wouldn't want to say that all the notes kept by people in companies are required records. Regularly kept records.
I believe there was testimony that this was a common corporate practice, but I don't recall exactly what that was. But I don't believe the foundation was suggested. This is another record point. I'll add that the court did allow in similar memos, but refused the.
Okay, well, thank you very much to both counsel. Next case for argument.